today we are reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 10, text number 10, verse number 13. Asata Sri Madandasya Daridriyam Param Anjanam Atmaupamyena Bhutani Daridra Param Ikshate Ashata Sri Matandasya Daridyam Param Anjanam Atmaupamyena Bhutani Daridra Param Ikshate Somebody? Atma pamyena bhutani daridra paramam ikshvate asata shri madandasya daridhyam paramanjanam atma pamyena bhutani Paritra paramikshate. Ladies? Atma pamyena bhutani daridra paramikshate asata shimadandasya daridriyam paramajanam atma pamyena bhutani Tadidra paramikshate asata of such a foolish rascal. Shimada andasya, who is blinded by temporarily possessing riches and opulence. Daridriyam, poverty. Param Anjanam, the best ointment for the eyes by which to see things as they are. Atma Aupamyena, with comparison to himself. Bhutani, living beings. Daridra, a poverty-stricken man. Param, perfectly. Ikshate, can see things as they are. Translation. Atheistic fools and rascals who are very much proud of wealth fail to see things as they are. Therefore, returning them to poverty is the a proper ointment for their eyes, so they may see things as they are. At least a poverty-stricken man can realize how painful poverty is, and therefore he will not want others to be in a painful condition like his own. purport by A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. Even today, if a man who was formerly poverty-stricken gets money, he is inclined to utilize his money to perform many philanthropic activities like opening schools for uneducated men and hospitals for the diseased. In this connection, there is an instructive story called Punar Musiko Bhava, Again, Become a Mouse. A mouse was very much harassed by a cat, and therefore the mouse approached a saintly person to request to become a cat. When the mouse became a cat, he was harassed by a dog. And then when he became a dog, he was harassed by a tiger. But when he became a tiger, he stared at the saintly person. And when the saintly person asked him, "What do you want?" the tiger said, "I want to eat you." Then the saintly person cursed him, saying, "May you again become a mouse." A similar thing is going on all over the universe. One is going up and down, sometimes becoming a mouse, sometimes a tiger, and so on. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu said, "Brahmanda brahmite kona bhagyavana jiva, guru krishna prasade paya bhakti lata bija." The living entities are promoted and degraded by the laws of nature. But if one is very, very fortunate, by association with saintly persons, he gets the seed of devotional service, and his life becomes successful. Narada Muni wanted to bring Nalakuvara and Manigriva to the platform of devotional service through poverty, and thus he cursed them. Such is the mercy of a Vaishnava. Unless one is brought to the Vaishnava platform, one cannot be a good man. Harav abhaktasya kuto mahat guna. A Vaishnava never becomes a good man, however severely he is punished. Omangyana timirandasya gina jana salakaya chakshur umanitam yena tasmai sugrave namaha. I was born in the darkness of ignorance, and my spiritual master opened my eyes with the torchlight of knowledge. I offer my respectful obeisances unto him. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So, for those of you who haven't been coming every day to Srimad Bhagavatam, you may not have the thread of the story. So I'll just catch you up a little bit. This story, this verse is embedded in a string of verses, which began with two sons of the god of wealth, or the lord of wealth, personified, Kuvera. And their names were Nalakuvera and Manigriva. And one day they were enjoying themselves in a naked, intoxicated state with naked women in the garden in the Ganges. And while they were doing this, there was a great wandering sage named Narada Muni, who is one of our gurus in our Parampara lineage. In fact, he's the son of the creator of the universe, Lord Brahma. And so although the women who were sporting naked with these two men in a drunken state had the sense of shame to cover themselves, when the saintly person Narada Muni came by, Nalakuvera and Manigriva, they did not. And so it's stated here in this verse that out of kindness, Narada Muni, he decided to curse them. To help them awaken from their ignorance that was preventing them from progressing in spiritual life. So this verse is actually very instructive to all of us. The first part says that those who are very proud of their wealth, they cannot see things as they are. And in the Vedic text, it describes that it's not just money that's wealth. It's also beauty. It's also having intelligence or having a superior education that makes one proud. There's so many things that one can possess that are material that makes a person proud. And Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that a person cannot see things as they are to being influenced by the modes of material nature, particularly the modes of passion and ignorance. And that's what lies behind a person's pride, their association with the modes of material nature. So how, we might ask ourselves, how does a person come to associate with the material nature after all? In the 11th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, it's explained, one who does not control the material senses comes under the control of material desires and is thus bewildered by the strong waves of the modes of passion. Such a person executes material activities, although clearly seeing that the result will be their future unhappiness. So it's kind of a paradox. People who are under the mode of passion, they're busy trying to enjoy themselves, but ultimately, they create suffering in the end. Their desires are completely reversed. So here it's explained that if a person indulges in unregulated sense gratification, their consciousness will come under the control of unlimited material desires, and then they become confused by the mode of passion. They become so confused that despite their wanting to be happy, their uncontrolled mind and senses actually compel them to engage in activities that will cause them unhappiness, as if by force. It's a energy that once one lends their behavior or their association to, it takes control of us, almost like we are intoxicated or we are possessed by another force, like a ghost. Even though we don't want to behave that way, the material energy embarrasses us. It forces us. In the 11th canto, it also describes a person bewildered by the mode of passion this way. Material desire, great endeavor, audacity, which literally means to be rude or disrespectful, dissatisfaction, even when there's gain, false pride, praying for material advancement. That's quite common. People come to the deities, they pray for a good job, they pray for getting into college, passing a test, considering oneself different and better than others. That's a very subtle way that the mode of passion is acting on us, that we are thinking, I'm better than you, I'm actually trying to convince you that I'm better than you. Engaging in sense gratification, rash. This word rash means a lack of careful consideration of the possible consequences of an action, that we are working so hard, we're moving so fast that we don't stop to consider what's going to be the consequences of my action. Eagerness to fight, a fondness for hearing oneself praised, the tendency to ridicule others, and advertising one's own prowess and justifying one's actions by one's strength. These are all attributes, qualities that we probably can identify at one time or another, ourselves either thinking or behaving like. In the 11th canto, it goes on to describe the qualities of a person in the mode of ignorance, which is a little notch below mode of passion. They become intolerant anger, which is rage, basically, stinginess, speaking without scriptural authority, violent hatred, living as a parasite, which means it's a person who habitually exploits others and gives nothing in return, hypocrisy, chronic fatigue, quarrel, lamentation, delusion, unhappiness, depression, sleeping too much, false expectations, fear, and laziness. These constitute the major qualities of a person under the influence of ignorance. So at any one time, the modes of material nature are competing for supremacy. So we may find ourselves in our mind even having these weird thoughts that we don't even believe in those things that our mind is proposing. And so we can just be able to identify, oh, that's not me. That's the modes working on me. I need to do my best to ignore those things and replace those thoughts with Krishna conscious thoughts. Finally, in the 11th canto, it describes a person in the mode of passion when, you know, how their intelligence becomes distorted due to too much activity. And by that, it means just moving from one minute to the other, busy doing, accomplishing a lot of stuff. And in this way, the consciousness becomes so distorted that they cannot disentangle their minds and their desiring propensity from their activities. Prabhupada said that he created this ISKCON society with so many activities so we could use that passionate energy in Krishna's service, because if we don't, it comes back on us to engage us in the material world in a way that will not be beneficial for ourselves. So all of this is pretty important information, that if we are engaged in too much activity, or if our devotional service is viewed or perceived by us in a material consciousness, then our intelligence actually becomes distorted and we lose our way. We can't see things as they are. So this is our situation while we're in the material world, our struggle to overcome these modes. And because our consciousness really is confused by associating with material nature. Krishna describes in the Bhagavad Gita that what is night for all beings is a time of awakening for the self-controlled. And the time of awakening for all beings is night for the introspective sage. So, you know, often the value system in the material world is exactly the opposite of what has value to us as aspiring Vaishnavas. We were discussing last night in the Bhagavad Gita class how we can even perform devotional service that is influenced by the modes of goodness, passion, and ignorance. In fact, it's true that as long as our chanting is not without offense, we can be sure that our devotional service is mixed with one or the other of those modes. I mean, as we struggle to purify our hearts and to chant particularly without any distraction, without any material attachment, we will see these different thought processes coming and influencing our behavior. The second part of this verse explains that when a person's consciousness becomes bewildered by pride that comes from wealth or other kinds of material possessions, then the appropriate cure for their spiritual blindness is to return to a poverty-stricken state. Now, sometimes people who are saintly or pious, they may choose to give everything away, or they leave home, or they begin to wander as a practice of getting clear about the goal of life and one purpose. But generally, people aren't that inclined. So it can be very, very beneficial, and we see this all the time, where people lose everything. People lose everything, perhaps they lose their job, or they lose the person they're dependent on for their finances, or they lose a particular body part that they needed in order to do their work, in order to make money. I see this all the time. Someone will suddenly become paralyzed and will not be able to use their hands. And by trade, they happen to be a craftsperson. And so now they can't use their hands, or they can't use their legs, or they can't use their mind. And so suddenly, from one moment to the next, they've lost everything. It says in this verse that when a person becomes bereft of all possessions, then they get to experience what it feels like to live in a state of poverty. And from that state of consciousness, they start to develop the awareness of how other people must suffer in a poverty-stricken state. So how does that help a person in spiritual life to be able to perceive the suffering of others and be compassionate? Because in a materially contaminated consciousness, a person has absolutely no compassion for other people. They have no interest. A person who is covered by the modes of passion and ignorance, they are self-righteous. And that word self-righteous means feeling morally superior due to their belief that their actions or their affiliations are better than others. We have this danger, particularly as people practicing Brahminical life. That's one of the biggest pitfalls of being a Brahmin, is that we tend to be self-righteous and we tend to judge others. This is a really bad habit that we tend to, is that we distinguish between ourselves as us and them instead of a human family that we're trying to help back to Godhead. So this whole practice of bhakti yoga is about our being beneficiaries of Krishna's compassion and being representatives of Krishna's compassion for other people. This quality of compassion is in response to other people's suffering is a hallmark of the Vaishnava. Is that when you see a person suffering, you can't tolerate it. It's unbearable. The natural tendency is, how can I help relieve that suffering? So a person under the influence of passion and ignorance has no compassion, because they're completely focused on getting their own personal needs met. No matter how subtle it is, it's still focused on getting my needs best. My needs are more important than yours. In behavioral sciences, we would call this narcissism. And by definition, a narcissist is someone who is extremely selfish, with a craving to be admired by others. And we can see in this Kali Yuga that this quality of narcissism is so pervasive. It's just... you're swimming in it all around you and also within ourselves. Krishna just says, the demons, or people who are covered by passionate ignorance, people who are completely overwhelmed by their narcissistic behavior, they believe that to gratify their senses unto the end of life is the prime necessity of human civilization. Thus, there's no end to their anxiety. Being bound by hundreds and thousands of desires, by lust and anger, they secure money by illegal means for sense gratification. Self-complacent and always impudent, deluded by wealth and false prestige, they sometimes perform sacrifices in name only, without following any rules or regulations. Bewildered by false ego, strength, pride, lust, anger, the demon becomes envious of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is situated in his own body and the bodies of others, and blasphemes against the real religion. This last verse is particularly interesting to me, that when a person becomes bewildered by false ego, this means they identify with their body as their self. They become proud of their bodily acquisitions and attributes, and they become lusty to satisfy their material desires. And then they become envious of God, who is living both within their own body as supersoul and the bodies of others. Prabhupada explains that there's three ways that we can envy the Supreme Person. The first way we can, demonstrate our envy of Krishna is that we attempt to be the supreme enjoyer. We try to control everything. We compete with God's plans. We try to control the situation in our favor rather than being able to cooperate with what Krishna provides us and what situations Krishna gives us in the here and now. The second way that a living entity demonstrates they are envious of Krishna is that they attempt to be the sole or primary enjoyer in a situation. Instead of dedicating all their thoughts, words, and actions in the service of Krishna's pleasure, their thoughts, words, and actions are dedicated to their own pleasure. They're making plans for their own pleasure, even if it just means having a comfortable situation. I mean, who can fault that everybody wants to feel comfortable? Everyone wants to have a certain level of health, which is, by the way, pretty much the only legitimate desire that Krishna affords us, is to have, to aspire for good health so that we can use our bodies and minds in Krishna's service. The third way that a living entity demonstrates their envy of the Supreme Lord is their attempt to be the friend of everyone. I always say this again and again because it's so pertinent. It is such a tricky piece. In our desire to be compassionate, often we get involved in relationships on the basis of trying to get our need for love and belonging met. I know as chaplains this is a real boundary issue when we're seeing people room after room, going to people, having conversations with people who really do need help. I mean, they're really suffering. And pretty much all of their suffering, they have created themselves. And so they're begging you for help. They want you to fix it for them. But the reality is you cannot help other people. This is a hard lesson for us because in our philanthropic notion and value system in the Western world, we think, well, we can alleviate other people's suffering by fixing it for them. But you don't help a person this way. The way you help actually alleviate a person's suffering is to teach them how they can stop making choices that create their suffering. That's real compassion. Otherwise, our friendship in the material world is really about getting our needs met. It isn't really selfless. It's about massaging our own false ego and trying to get our need for love and belonging met by those we attempt to establish friendships with. So, in this verse, this Nalaku Vera and Mani Griva, they are kind of a archetype for all the half-naked, intoxicated young men and women who are proud of their material acquisitions in this world, who have absolutely no respect for saintly people like Narada Muni. And, you know, we are all coming in the line of Narada Muni, who in our lineage calls us to go out to people who are completely intoxicated by the mode of passion and ignorance and try somehow or other to encourage them, to inspire them, to choose another path. Why? Because we know that that path will eventually, if not more immediately, lead to more suffering. And out of compassion for them, we want to try and help them avoid that suffering. In today's society, we may not think about it when we think of intoxication, but the whole culture runs on caffeine. I mean, think about it. People cannot even, the clergy person, priests and pastors, they cannot sit and do a homily in their church until they've had at least 5 cups of coffee. So this is intoxication. If you're not able to function without a ton of coffee, this means you have an addiction. This is a drug. It's also considered in research that white sugar is just a couple of grains away from cocaine. It can be an addiction as well, having your sugar fix. I know Brahmins love sugar and we should have some sweet foods, but we can also get seriously addicted to sugar. I know when I take too much, I can feel my heart, you know, just like if you're taking some hard drug, I suppose, my heart starts to palpitate. So in the Vedic civilization, for a person to appear publicly naked or even half naked, sporting with the opposite sex in an intoxicated state was considered to be grounds for arrest as a criminal activity. And I just came back from Mayapur via Abu Dhabi, where I had a stopover for about 8 hours. And I had a conversation with an American who was working there at the airport. And he said that they actually have religious police in Abu Dhabi, in Muslim countries, that go and they will arrest people if they're intoxicated in public or if they're not dressed appropriately. Hence, they are wearing this enormous get-up that people in the West sometimes find strange. It's an effort to not agitate the public by inappropriate dress. But as well, according to the laws of material nature, the behavior of most modern society is criminal and actually is liable for punishment by the laws of material nature. We don't make those laws. They are given laws just like gravity. And so people don't know that by behaving in an unregulated sensual way, it's going to lead to their suffering. And we can see this in the form of disease, particularly sexually transmitted diseases. You know, people think that they are having a good time until, now they have AIDS, or, they have syphilis, or, and that's a life changer. And it's an incredible life of suffering after that. So what's the solution for all this criminal behavior? I mean, it's nice to complain about all the criminality, but what is the solution? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, in his 8 verses of Shikshastika, right at the beginning, he says that this Krishna, Sri Krishna Sankirtan, cleanses the heart of all the dust accumulated for years and extinguishes the fire of conditional life of repeated birth and death, which is really what we're moving towards. Why we want to get out of this cycle is because we want to be finished with our desire to come and pretend that we are little gods in this material world. The solution to the crime problem is to cleanse the dust or dirt from our hearts and cleanse the dust and dirt from the hearts of others who are around us. And the way we do that is a very simple process of chanting in congregation the holy names of the Lord. In 1975, Srila Prabhupada, he had a conversation with a Lieutenant Mosey or something in police lieutenant in Chicago. And he was explaining how the only difference between a pious person and a criminal is that their heart was pure. The heart of the criminal was simply filled with dirt or psychic dirt. We call those sanskaras or, you know, impressions that are impure. And so this heart, Prabhupada, this dust or dirt, Prabhupada explains, is like a disease which manifests as uncontrollable lust and greed. And Prabhupada says quite simply, if a person's heart becomes purified of these dirty things, then the criminal behavior will immediately stop. And he explained again that the simplest way for purifying that dust that leads to criminality is simply to chant Hare Krishna, particularly in the association of devotees. So all the propaganda around crime and many times people in the prisons who have been arrested for crime, they are medicated so much that they're brain dead. So there's no hope of them having any awareness of the holy name or chanting it. And so for the rest of forever, not only in this life, perhaps in other lives, they are completely bound up in this cycle of forgetfulness. So back to the story. Narada Muni, who is one of the original gurus in our Vaishnava Sampradaya, he mercifully showed his compassion to these two drunken persons by cursing them to become poverty-stricken. And so when a person becomes proud, they think they're the owners and controllers and enjoyers, and their focus is on themselves. And so when a person now has nothing, then they start to appreciate the suffering of others. And this law of karma is very, very stringent. It's very, very exact. We may think that there's an immediate cause. Something happens to us. We get in a car accident or we get an illness or whatever. And we blame it on the immediate cause. But the reality is Krishna is intimately connected with each of us. And he's creating our allurement. He's trying to attract us back to him. So he may allow or sanction something very painful to happen to us in order for us to wake up. I remember when I was doing my chaplain training on the border of Mexico and Arizona in a hospital, my very, very first patient I had to see had been a mother. She was a 28-year-old young mother with a 2-year-old who was at a shopping center, one of these big malls, and she was loading things in the back of her station wagon, you know, with the back down. There was a group of teenagers who were intoxicated on crack cocaine. Arizona is kind of the methamphetamine capital of the world, but a lot of intoxicated people driving cars. And they happened to run into her from the back and slice her legs from the knees, just completely from one moment to the next. Her 2-year-old was sitting on the sidewalk with the grandmother watching. She fell to the ground, and immediately, of course, you know the next thing is your body is just losing tons of blood. So there she is laying in the parking lot, having lost both her legs, who is sitting over there. And they bring her to the hospital. And so my first call was to go and visit this woman. And before I went there, I had a consultation with her husband, who was, of course, overwhelmed with shock and despair. And he said to me, you know, it's a very interesting thing about my wife. She is a principal of an elementary school, very beautiful woman. He said, but she had a shoe fetish. She had 100 million shoes in her closet. That was her biggest addiction, is that she loved shoes. And he said, isn't it interesting that from now on she will never be able to wear all those lovely shoes? And that was a complete God shot for me in my mind, thinking, isn't it amazing how the hand of God moves very slowly but very exactly, tailor-made, to help us. It was actually complete mercy for her. That was probably the one obstacle in her spiritual growth, was this addiction to shoes. It sounds silly to us who probably have one pair of flip-flops in our closet, but some people have very amazing, unusual addictions to things. You just have to step inside someone's mind and be horrified and amazed. But this is our situation. It's that it's mercy. And until we start to see how Krishna is directly and personally involving himself in trying to get our attention, if we don't hear the small voice, Krishna is all the time speaking to us. If we don't hear the whisper, if we don't listen, or if we're not intentional about listening, Krishna has to give us a little bit of, you know, come on, wake up. You know, you're not listening. Get it. And often it leads you to a calamity of major proportions that ends you in the hospital. We see this when people come in the hospital. This is a cry for help. It's not a spirit. It is not a physical thing that brings in the hospital. It's a spiritual crisis again and again and again. And as you start to explore what brought them to the hospital, what they need to repair to heal themselves, you start to see it's a spiritual crisis that brings you the dis-ease and the anxiety that goes with it. So I'm aware of the time, so I don't want to take too long, but I know the last part of this verse. It's explaining how the way out of this dangerous situation, this dangerous material life where every step is a danger. Padam padam yadvi padam natesham. Every step is dangerous. We have to somehow or other come in contact with a pure devotee who can lend us his vision, lend us his wisdom to help guide us out of the ridiculous influence that we all are under by the modes of material nature. Thankfully, we have Prabhupada's association through his books and the Srimad Bhagavatam, that is a book or an encyclopedia full of stories of people who have been elevated from the platform of Nalakovera and Manigriva, who have been intoxicated by material life in one way or the other, either by material opulence or despair, and have been picked up just by a moment's association of a pure devotee of Vaishnava. And so we have these associations where we can come together, we can chant together, we can take shelter of each other, those of us who see that there's someone in our association who we might take knowledge from. We can humbly submit ourselves and inquire. And if we happen to be fortunate enough to be rightly situated or very well established in devotional service, then we can help others to progress. Those are the three different ways we associate in Vaishnava association or community, is that if we're more advanced, then we help those who are less advanced without becoming annoyed or fed up or impatient, which is generally what happens, you know, when we forget, oh, we were a learner too. We were a beginner too. And so we can get really impatient. Well, why don't you know that? You should know that already. Well, I don't know what I don't know. I'm new. I don't know. And if we're new and we're just learning, then it makes sense to find out who we can trust and ask questions and then try to get that association that way. And if we're peers, and we have also peers in the community where we've joined about the same time, we're at the same same level of spiritual life, to make friendships without competing, without one-upping each other, without putting each other down, but encouraging each other's devotional service. It's actually envy that's the only emotion that is not in the spiritual world. Anger is there, love is there, sadness is there, grief is there, but envy is the one quality that if you have and you harbor, the gates of the spiritual world are completely closed to you. So we need to practice in the association of our peers, working in collaboration without being judgmental and ridiculing one another. So I'm going to stop here, aware that maybe someone has a question or comment. Welcome for those of you who may have been at Bhagavad Gita last night, some of you. Do you have any questions or comments or something you'd like to add? Yes.
In the lower modes, how they have no compassion.
You know, I have them, it's in the 11th canto, and I read a series of verses. If you want, I can give them to you after.
Okay.
But it's in the 11th canto that's all discussed, as well as Bhagavad Gita, it talks about it. But I'm talking about spiritual compassion versus just being compassionate on someone's bodily situation. Uh-huh. Is that what you were asking about?
Well, it's so many ways of describing compassion. You know, there's real compassion, like, you know, the false compassion is like the example is given of saving somebody's drowning, you save his coat, you know.
Right.
You know, but anyway.
And you know, you bring up a good point, Rabindranath, is that this is very confusing to a lot of even devotees who are affiliated with the Hare Krishna movement. It's something I've had to wake up to as a chaplain who kind of went out and got involved in education, and I got kind of busy in learning about compassion and how to be really compassionate. And what I ended up with is that a lot of the compassion that we see in this world, like opening hospitals and schools and homeless shelters and all of that, is really philanthropy. Yeah. And a lot of it is really fed by a materialist consciousness that wants to feel good about their own selfishness.
Yeah.
So, okay, I'm going to give a little percent to people on the bodily platform. Yes.
Thank you for a very wonderful class, Rambha Ramati.
Oh, you're welcome, Archita.
One obvious question that can arise from this verse purport and your presentation is, does material poverty actually benefit somebody? It seems to indicate that in the verse that if you're put in a poverty stricken situation, then you automatically become compassionate and don't want others to suffer like that. But we see quite the opposite, especially in today's society, it seems to be getting worse and worse, that those who are poor, the 99%, the have-nots, they're extremely envious of those who have, and they make other people's lives miserable by taking them from them either surreptitiously or by force, and quite often, it's not the Robin Hood principle that I'm going to take from the rich and give to the poor. Quite often, they take from other poor people.
I know.
You know, there are so many stories. A poor kid somewhere or other gets an iPod or an iPhone walking down the street, and another poor kid will hit him over the head and take it away. You know, so it's not that they try to take from others who have necessarily. They just take from anyone because they think that they deserve without working. They should get whatever they want, whatever they think they need.
No, and that's a good point. It's kind of a double-edged sword, and it has a lot to do. It's very contextualized and very personalized, too. Because poverty, in the Vedas, it says the poverty can bring out the worst in a person also. And that's in the material world. I would say that a person who is meant to or ripe for coming to spiritual life will benefit or see it in a spiritual way. It's like when a person is in material consciousness, what happens to him, he sees as, it's like a karmic reaction. It's a kick from the prongs of Durga Devi. But when a person has surrendered their life to Krishna, he starts to see how Krishna is interacting. So it's really a question of personalized and context. Neela.
Hare Krishna. I was thinking how, you know, one point in one of the lectures, I remember it a little vaguely, but like, if there's Krishna consciousness, then if one is wealthy, they can utilize that wealth, build a temple, feed people. And if one doesn't have, then they can also engage in Krishna consciousness and participate in it. And if we all have a spiritual focus, then, you know, then we can live very simply and be rich in our Krishna consciousness. That's really the wealth right there. After all, we need something to keep body and soul together. But I was thinking of Queen Kunti, how she was mentioning in the first canto all these problems that the Pandavas had undergone, and they had an opportunity to remember Krishna, even though they were very poor materially at one point, losing their whole kingdom and in the forest. And then they got the whole kingdom, and she had lamented how Krishna is going away now, and she says, "I don't want that. You know, I want to be back. I hope these calamities happen again to me, so that I can remember Krishna." So, I just wanted.
Well, it's really true that when we have material opulence, even material sense gratification is the enemy of spiritual life. We can notice if we fast on our fast days that, you know, by the end of the day you're tired and fatigued, but you're chanting like hell, you know, and your chanting takes on a different quality, and then you eat the feast, and then it's, you know, the whole consciousness goes boom, you know, or it could be depending on, you know, how much you eat and the consciousness with which you eat it. But it's true that the more material comfort you have, the more we get bewildered. And so it doesn't mean we shouldn't have our basic needs met. I mean, that's given too.
Thank you, Mati. Wonderful, mature realizations, and we need that.
Thank you.
I hope you can keep accepting, speaking more like that. So this topic of compassion is very... It's like unlimited, and you can bring it up in different ways. For example, I was thinking that the outside world, philanthropic is So, I analyze myself and I see that after many years, do I really feel compassion? And then I came to the conclusion that actually, you know, intellectually, you go to Vaishnavas, Prabhupada, Bhagavad Gita, and all the Swamis, they have the compassion. So, I'm just working that they're very sheltered.
We know it here. We know it there. Yes.
And sometimes for a family member, you can feel that because it's really close. And then somebody could say, well, it's more like a violent concept of life, in a sense, in a way.
Yeah, it's an extension of yourself. Yeah. Yeah, it's a common, I mean, this is part of the training for a chaplain. I mean, you're seeing some awful, awful things that people have done to themselves and to other people. Murdering children, you know, unbelievable things. I can't even mention it. It'll give you nightmares. And having to be able to come in as an unconditionally loving presence for them, because you know that's the one thing that will heal people. It's the only thing that will heal, whether in the material or the spiritual world, is for them to experience the unconditional love that God has for each of us. And you, as the servant of God, have to embody that, as Prabhupada did. He embodied it. My God, from where he's sitting, looking out at us, now, 45 years later, I'm realizing, oh my God, he was so tolerant of us and some of the things that we were doing. But the way to do it, the trick is to be able to see yourself in them and know, oh, I have the capability of doing that too. I can remember when I did that myself. I can remember when I said something idiotic like that. We have to be able to move to empathy, to see ourselves in the behavior of other people and realize it's not them. It's the modes working on them. It's not them. So you've got to be self-differentiating and discerning to know that Krishna is directing the wanderings, and somehow or other they have been allowed to say and do all those things, and maybe saying things insulting to you. You have to know that's mercy for you and understand that it's not them. It is not them. They are perfect, pure spiritual beings when you take all that away. And that's what we're trying to help manifest in them. And the interesting thing about that is when you treat a person like they are a devotee, even if they're not, if you relate to a person as a person, as a part of Krishna, they tend to come up to that standard of behavior as well. People will tend to behave to that degree you project onto them. So the like Prabhupada, he treated us like we were respectable human beings, although we were a bunch of intoxicated hippies when we met him. And so we came up to his level of vision on his strength. Does that help? Okay. We have to stop. I think there's prasadam. Hare Krishna.